News of Amalfi, Boxing Day, December the 26th, 1943. As if Christmas had not been wonderful enough, out of the line, dry beds, good grub visits to Naples with free venereal disease. Yet we get more good news. It was like hearing you'd won the Irish sweepstake the moment you'd just discovered gold in your garden. We were in bed after our concert when down the line came the message. The following personnel will proceed on 4 days' leave to Amalfi Agra rest camp. And lo, it's all the concert party. Amalfi, says Edgington, rearranging his cigarettes for the night. What is an Amalfi, said White. It sounds like a high-powered high-time motor car, says Edgington. But I know all, well-educated Milligan tell them. It's an Italian village that lies along the Divine Coast, south of Naples and southeast of Catford, about 600 miles southeast of Catford, I say. Amalfi, there must be some mistake. Gunners don't go to the Divine Coast. They go to the Kazi. But, folks, it was all true. 9:30, Monday, December the 27th, 1943. We were all loaded onto the three-tonner like merry cattle. We are all in cracking spirits. December the 27th was a crisp, sunny morning, though Edgington is overcast, cloudy, with rain and high ground. I had a drop too much last night, he said. It was a mere 1,000 feet, he said, imitating W.C. Fields. Mere 1,000 feet. I continued the same voice. It's perfectly true, my dear. He was making love to Grace on the hilltop when suddenly he went over the side. That's how he fell from grace. Groans, groans, oh, groans. From the back, we were watching the column of military traffic going up the line, and in between the pitiful civilian transport. There were loads of pretty girls who came under fire from the tailboard. They ranged from cries like, I can do you a power of good, my dear, to the less poetic, me give you 10 inches of pork sword, darling. It's strange. None of the soldiers in Shakespeare talked like this. If Shakespeare had been in the army, it would have sounded more like this. Once more into the breach, dear friends, once more. Caw, look at those knockers. Or fill up this wall with our English dead. Oh, grab hold of this, darling. We're travelling south down Route 6, along the line of the Roman road. It's not the Via Appia, said Edgington, but I, ha-ha, have, ha-ha-ha, never been Appia. Groans, more groans. He pretends to hurl himself out of the lorry. Ah! The roads were really a series of holes joined together. We spent the time yo-yoing between the floor and the roof of the lorry. Sometimes, to ease the jolting, we hung onto the roof supports with our feet off the floor, making monkey faces and scratching under the arms. All clever stuff. Edgington is demonstrating how he can hang by his insteps. We hit a bump. He goes straight down onto his nut. Ah! A few songs to alleviate the boredom. I never forget the day I joined the army on spee, to beat a greasy gunner in the draw artillery tea, for my heart is aching and breaking, to be in Civvy Street once more. Oh, you ought to see the drivers on a Friday night, upon us up their harness in the pale moonlight, for there's going to be inspection in the morning, and the battery sergeant major will be there, he'll be there. He'll be there in the little arms room across the square. And when they're filing out the water, I'll be shagging the colonel's daughter in the little arms room across the square. Oh, I'd come a long way since I was an altar boy at St. Saviour's Church, Broccoli Rise. We're going through Capua at a speed that would have left Hannibal and his lads long way behind. Driver Wilson has put a spurt on, and we are being shook to buggery. I clasped my legs. Oh! What's up, said Edgington. Oh, nothing, I said. Just practicing for an accident. On through Santa Maria, Afrigola, the outskirts of Naples. At Piazza Dante, we get out to stretch our legs and have a slash. We are besieged by Neapolitan street urchins, scugnazzi, who sell everything from cigarettes to their sisters. How could they ever live normal lives after this? The square is a mass of lorries, jeeps and trucks, Large numbers of soldiers, drunk and otherwise, are either arriving or leaving. The Americans are bumptious. They have a great sense of humour. If you're about five. Come on, you lot. We're leaving, Driver Wilson is yelling above the noise. On to Amalfi. It's still a nice clear day, but cold. The sun shines and bounces off the Gulf of Napoli. To our left looms Mount Vesuvius. White smoke drifts lazily from its crater. I wonder who's working the boiler room, says Griffin. Gunner jammed our Griffin. He was big, gawky, dark-haired, brown-eyed, 6 foot. When unshaven, he looked like the villain in a Mickey Mouse comic. I never saw him down. In fact, he was far too often up. A great morale booster. He had a huge pipe in which he never seemed to have any baccy. He had the greatest guffaw I ever heard, which you can even hear above the guns. He was one of the real characters, therefore invaluable in the run of human affairs. We had been 4 hours on the truck, and boredom had set in. Lots of the lads were squatted on the floor trying to doze. Only a few occasional words were heard.
"Bloody lost, ain't we?" says Vic Nash.
"Are we lost?" he shouts to the canvas of the driver. "No, we're not bloody lost," the reply. "Stop moaning or I'll go in reverse." Is Amalfi in Italy?" says Deans and looks at me. "It is in Italy, and we must nearly be there." As I speak, we turn off the main Salerno road, and lo, we are on a small coastal road with a sign saying, "Amalfi, cheers." We all perk up. The view from the back of the lorry starts to get beautiful. The sea on the left and mountains to our right. We have many hairy moments trying to negotiate the numerous bends with loony Italian drivers coming the other way. Snuggled along this coast were small fishing villages that looked like those over-syrupy buildings in Disney cartoons, and yet they were real. The war had been kind to this coast. The only sign of destruction was us.
Oh, Christ. How much longer?
5 bloody hours? You can fly from London to Moscow in that time. A small squad of unshaven carabinieri come marching along the narrow road, and they are broken up by the passing of our lorry. They reform and continue to march happily and smartly out of step. The lorry is stopping! Amalfi! Cheers! We pull up on the seafront. Opposite is a large barrack-like building. A freshly painted white sign says, Tuaregra Rest Camp. Oh, cheers. The whole village is built on steps that ascend up to the mountains. The buildings are a mixture of white, sky blue, pink and deep blue. Down the centre of the village runs a stream. I could see the odd lady doing her laundry in it and several small boys doing other things in it. The whole place has architectural maturity. There are numerous creepers and vines growing in profusion on the walls and the balconies. In summer, it must be a riot of flowers. Right now, it's a riot of gunners. There's a scramble as we dash for the best beds, if any. A bombardier, all base depot smartness personified, says, Follow me, 90-battery personnel. Alf files diary. Great! Tablecloths, writing in leisure room, laundry facilities, barbers and spring beds in the dormitories. No roll calls. Breakfast from 7:30 till 8:30. We are on the third floor in a dormitory of about, say, 30 beds. No pictures, no curtains, no chairs, just beds. Eddington is testing his bed. His usual method, 10 paces back, run, then hurl yourself on it. Well, seems all right, he said. A resident says the grub here was not so good, but there were plenty of keefs in the town. We dump our kit and make for outside. There's a great echoing, thumping sound as we all last one down as an idiot down the stone steps. The town sloped uphill from the waterfront. Running along the flanking hills were the remains of 45 walls and crumbling turrets, an echo of days when the Moors raided the coast. What was unusual was a large basilica almost on the beach, and more wondrous, sculptures by Michelangelo. An even more important work of art was a sign with the magic word, eggs and chips. I remember so well the sheer magnificence of smelling food being prepared continental style, be it only eggs and chips. Through our cafe window the sun shone. It was a great feeling, being safe, eating foods off china plates, and 4 days of it ahead of us. Whoopee!
I'd forgotten what it was like to feel happy, said Edgington as he spoke his victuals in.
We wandered around Amalfi, bought postcards, walked up and down the seafront, even down and up. We tried to chat the senorinas, but no dice. I thought perhaps when I said, me, a Roman Catholic, might break the ice, but no. I tried me Protestant, me Jewish, me methylated spirits. Nothing. Chalky White looms up from behind the seawall. Ah, I've been sunbathing, he says. What sadist sent us to the seaside in December? Hey, hey.
It's late evening. Nightlife consists of going to bed. We troop back to the leisure room to play darts. Dinner is bully beef. It's not bad, but somehow eating bully beef in Amalfi is like ordering beans on toast at Maxim in Paris. We're a restless soul. We decide to go for a stroll. It's dark. In the distance we can hear ack ack. God knows where from. It's a reminder of what we have to go back to. We walked up the steps that ran alongside the stream and ascended slowly until we reached a cafe. We entered a small room full of soldiers drinking. Alf and I sat down and ordered a couple of brandies. The room was blue with cigarette smoke. A fat-bottomed girl was carrying the drinks to the table, and those who were bum-brushed seemed well-favoured. One drunk was singing self-indulgent songs.
It's my... I'm a birthday... today,
or some such crap. Ah, the fat bottom is approaching us. She has a lovely, plump, smiling face with brown eyes as large as walnuts and glistening like oiled olives. She smiles, places our glasses before us. Signori, she utters.
Caw, we replied.
I'm tired. Let's go, said Alf. We picked our way down the steps, no sound save the cascading water running down to the sea. Most of the lads were in bed, except Edgington. He's writing Peg one of his letters. That could mean a 3-hour stint ending with swollen balls. I just fell into the bed. Springs! Oh, it was marvellous. Blackout.
December the 28th, 1943. I am aroused in the early hours. Bitten to death. My bed is alive with bugs. I'm worried about getting typhus. I reported to the duty bombardier. He's nonplussed.
Oh, why you and no one else, he says.
Yes, why me and no one else, I said. With my clothes off, I looked like I'd been sandpapered. I reported the M.O. A 45-year-old base depot drunk, recovering from last night's piss-up. With eyes like smoked glass windows, he examines me and says with authority,
you have been bitten by something.
Have I? I said.
Yes. Have you had your typhus injection?
Yes, I said very quickly. Good, he said. He wrote me a prescription for a bottle of chamomile mixture.
Have a good shower, said the orderly, then rub it in.
I retired to the showers. They're ice cold, aren't they? My screams ring through the building. Covered in pink liquid, I dress and join the lads in the restroom. Alf Files and I decide to look around the shops. He has already been around and been accosted by 2 girls who called him Hello Baby.
Hello Baby? I thought it looked older than that.
With my face a mass of red blotches, Files and I appraise the goods in the windows.
What bloody prices, he moaned.
I was flat broke and living on money borrowed from Edgington, who in turn was living on money borrowed from Vic Nash. It didn't deter me from going into the shop, just to chat up the shop girls, all of whom looked ravishingly beautiful. We returned to the billets for lunch, an indifferent affair of stew, potato, bread, rice pudding and tea. It tasted best if you mixed the lot together. Still, it went down well, and you could hear the crash.
Now what, said Edgington as we wash our Dixies.
The ballet, the opera, or pontoon al fresco?
We're only here 4 days, you know. If we must act quickly.
All right, then. Hamlet in 4 seconds. To be or not to be, is that the question? The billet notice board recommended a visit to Ravello. This was at the top of the hill, directly above Amalfi, So the gang of us set off. Spike Deans, Harry Edgington, James R. Griffin, George Shipman, Alf Files, Reg Bennett and Ken Carter.
They say it's very nice up there, said Ken Carter.
It's a long way to the top, said the bombardier from the billets.
We start walking. The afternoon was bright, with a slight haze out to sea. As we ascend, I observed a profusion of semi-tropical plants growing from the slopes. There were even small alpine-type flowers growing amid rocks. Gradually, the view unfolded onto the sea and the divine coast. It was superb.
They say that when an Amalfian dies and goes to heaven, it's just another day for them, spoke Spike Deans.
What if he goes to hell? Gaffaw's Jamjar Griffin. Well, you'd be able to welcome them and tell them one of your crappy jokes, and then they'd know the bloody hell we've been suffering from you, says Edgington.
Jamjar reacts. Listen, Puddin, where I come from, they think I'm in an old coward class.
There's an explosion of disbelieving laughter. He tries to retain his dignity by shouting about it.
I've sung in Doyley Cart. You've never even sung in a fucking dust cart, said Gunnar Nash.
More howling laughter.
There's nothing so funny as a disoriented jam jar. He realized he was in a losing wicket, so he joined in the laughter.
What do I care, he roared. You can't effort if you're a load of ignorant buggers.
We made it by mid-afternoon. Ravello was magic. It had called the great from many countries. Mozart, Wagner, Greta Garbo, the Duke of Windsor, and now Lance Bommardier Milligan S. Ravello was the seat of the princes of Ruffolo. In the centre of the town was the piazza, with the Cinquecento Chiesa. Inside, one is overwhelmed at the artistry, from the chased silver keyholes in the doors to the magnificent marble-sculptured pulpit turned into lace by artisans, with the images of the Ruffolo family entwined in the façade. There's a beautiful bust of the matriarch of the Ruffolos, but blast! I can't even remember her name. Was it Rita? Doris? It might be in the yellow pages. The piece inside was shattering. George Shipman, to our amazement, played 3 Purcell pieces on the organ. We had no idea he could play the organ, and neither did he. The music soared as only an organ can. I sat in what had been the ducal pew, and gazed at the complex of the marble that made up the altar. Like all worked marble of the day, it was a masterpiece. The vaulted ceilings, however, were free of decoration, just plain whitewash, which caught the light and gave the interior the effect of sunshine through gauze. We all felt like a cup of tea. In the piazza, we entered a little cave. They made us a lovely pot of brown hot water with some very nice Italian pastries. The place is almost deserted, save for a few waiters suffering touristic withdrawal symptoms.
Before war come many a peoples, English, plenty English, English very rich, said a waiter, looking at me.
I stood up and sang God Save the King, at the same time pulling out the empty linings of my pocket. He understood, and soon he too displayed his empty pockets. We sat down, and he had tea and cakes with us. It was Kent Carter who was flush with money. As it appears that 90 battery are almost skint, we of the 70-volt mediums will pay. At these words, Edgington and I took off our hats, prostrated ourselves on the pavement and kissed his boots. He tried to shoo us off, but we stuck to him like leeches, grovelling to him and shouting, "Thank ye, young master. God bless ye." Now what? The place to see, apparently, was the gardens of the palace, listed as the Belvedere del Cimbroni. Even though it wasn't the flowering season, the gardens were a sheer delight to the eye. Scrubs, bushes, trees, all placed with the uttermost precision to create an atmosphere of relaxation and tranquility. A central ornate marble fountain played watery tunes from its moulded lead faucets surmounted by stone cherubim. It was so planned as to avoid any view of the sea until one arrived at the tiled terrace, which was reached through a small replica of a triumphal arch, alas, now stripped of its marble.
See? We're not the only ones who've lost our marble, said Edgington.
It was sunset. Standing on the abutment of the Villa Cimbroni, we are looking out to sea that lay like polished jade. Away to our left, about to be swallowed in an autumn mist, was the sweep of the Salerno coast, running away into the distance like an unfinished song. I stood long next to Harry Edgington. There was no noise, no trains, motorbikes, motor cars, barking dogs, transistor radios. It was a moment that was being indelibly etched in my mind for life. I felt part of history. Wagner had stood on this spot. What went through his head? From what I hear, it was, "Which Italian bird can I make with a scroll tonight, my dear?" "We'd better get something to eat," said the soft voice of Bombardier Ken Carter. "Ah, but where?" "Let's go back to the piazza," I said. "There might be something there."
"I don't remember seeing anything there," said Edgington.
"You must remember seeing something, Harry. If it's only the floor. I mean, you were only there half an hour ago." "Your power to bend words," he said, "will one day end you in the Nick, the Nut House, or graveyard." We reached the piazza as twilight was touching the adjacent hills. "You lads look give us something," a wavery female cockney voice. Standing by the gate of a whitewashed wall was a small, skinny lady of about 50, or 1,000. "See, speaking cockney," whispered Edgington from the corner of his mouth. "Perhaps she's lost," I said. "We're looking for some mangiare," I said, and automatically did the sign of eating. "No need to make signs for me, darling," said the amazing cockney voice. "I lived in London for 40 years. With the Romans, I thought. She then told us the good news that was to lead to an unforgettable night. "Come on in. We can fix you up with eggs and chips and some wine. That'll do you, won't it?" she said, and gave that forced cockney laugh of embarrassment. We followed her to a terrace that had a sensational view down a precipitous mountain that concluded with the sea. In a small, plain, wine-coloured room, adorned with a few religious pictures and a mixture of stern-faced Neapolitan grandfathers, grandmothers, and children in communion white, we sat around a central table with a tablecloth that looked suspiciously like a bedsheet. I hope I wasn't at the feet end. Chattering, she plonked down 2 large carafes of red wine. "There, that'll keep you going till din-dins." She disappeared into the back room, where she reverted to broad Neapolitan and shouting. She was answered by a male voice that appeared to have a sandpaper lining to his throat. That, or his appliance had slipped. To Edgington's joy, there was a piano against the wall. The first notes of Tangerine, and we all joined in memory of our North African concert party days. Outside, the crepuscous twilight was moving along the Amalfian coast. "Aha! Eggs and chip, Italian style, with spaghetti have arrived." "Heavens alive!" exclaimed Edgington. A man brought up on roast beef and 2 veg. "Spaghetti with eggs," he chortled. "Now that's what Catholicism does for you." I observed the faces of my comrades, the same expression I observed 1,000 times. It is when, for a moment, conversation stills at the sight of the food, the communal spirit is temporarily forgotten, and each man is only aware of himself, his stomach, and the pleasant preparatory taste of salivary juices in his stomach. A half-smile was on the face of all of them, except Jamjar. His face took on the appearance of a cougar about to kill. "There you are, me darling," said a little lady, balancing 4 plates along her arm. There followed that urgent rattling of cutlery, knives and forks, foraging like hungry wolves among the repast. There's the usual insult to culinary art, snowstorms of salt and pepper. I saw her wince at the request for tomato sauce. A husband appeared, a replica of Henry Armetta. Short, fat, greasy, amicable. He grinned and made that little nodding gesture of the head peculiar to Italians. On reflection, it would look peculiar on anybody.
Buona, eh?
Si, molto buono, we chorused. Pressing my linguist abilities, I said, "Se voglio un bicchiere di vino." By his facial reaction, I could have been speaking Chinese. Even worse, he said, "Scusi me, ma ni, I know, non parla francese." They had a drink with us. "Here's a victory to the Allies," he said. That got rid of all the wine. 2 more carafes arrived. But then we drank a salute, Italia, viva il re. That got rid of 2 more. From the bread on the table, Janjar Griffin was wiping the last of the egg off his plate. "You leave the pattern on, mate," said Carter. "Now, would you like a sweet?" said our lady of the food. "We've got lots of eggs here, a barrel masala in the cellar, and a special treat we could give you all a zabaglione. There was the stunned silence of culinary illiterates. Tactfully, she explained what it was, how it was made, how it tasted. It was made in honour of General Zabaglione. I believe he was one of Garibaldi's generals. How could we refuse this offer? In great anticipation, we proceeded to destroy our taste buds with State Express 555. Overwhelmed with musical ego, I sat at the piano and played a very dodgy version of Body and Soul. "That's a lovely tune," said Carter. "Yes, it is," I said. "Then why play it?" he said. "It's coming," said Edgington, cupping his ear in the direction of the kitchen, from whence came noises, in the wake of which our Madonna of the Seven Teeth came forth with a tray with six glasses of yellowish stuff. Slight apprehension, except Jamjar, who was into it like Dracula into a throat. "It's custard," he said. "That's it, of course. Zabaglione is Italian for custard." It was the turn of Lance Bombardier Carter to play the piano. "They laughed when I sat down to play the piano," he said, "but when I played, they became hysterical." We all giggled and laughed. Mind you, at this stage, we would have giggled and laughed if we'd been told we had only a week to live. He played his own composition called Candlelight. I still, to this day, sometimes find myself humming it. Strange, when I was writing about this particular incident, I phoned Kent and asked him if he could remember the words. He said, "Yes, I've got them somewhere. I'll dig them out and let you have them." That night, Ken died in his sleep. Outside, night had fallen along the Malfian coast. With Ken still playing those incredibly romantic tunes of the 40s, Harry and I went and looked at the view outside. It was a vast, velvety panorama. The moon lit the whole scene. The clarity was startling, like sunlight through blue-tinted glass. I could hear distant singing drifting upwards from the sea. I noticed boats with tiny yellow lamps like fairy lanterns on the water, and a rhythmic beating of course, it was the pescatories attracting the fish. It was all like a magic painting. I'm including now Harry Edgington's recollections of that evening, written in 1977. But to the memories of that evening of that day, which, as I've already said, are not continuous or consecutive in their order. How we got to that establishment, virtually on the brink of 2,000 feet high coastline, I haven't a clue. Whether it was a private house or a cafe, I couldn't tell you. I can recall that we sat out on the stone-flagged terrace with disconcertingly thin wrought iron railings. We were there for perhaps an hour, while evening gave way to twilight and eventually to a fine calm night over which the mystery moon queened it in peculiar fashion, cutting a massive fan-shaped swathe across the millpond calmness of the Med directly towards us, and so it seemed. We were too overawed by the scene to talk much. Far below, the fishermen's boats were intriguing us. Lanterns on the prow, the singing of the fishermen came wafting up 2,000 feet as they banged on the sides of the boats with pieces of wood. The sounds on the side came to us so perfectly focused, so clear as the moonlight. So we just drank in the scene, which, I would say, was starkly rather than restfully beautiful. Right. Now, back in the little dining room, the romantic moon had gone, and Jamjar Griffin was in the middle of a magnificent rendering of Poor Blind Nell, who, in 32 bars of music, had more perversions committed on her than a victim of Caligula. Reds Bennett played Blue Moon, and then Follow My Heart, My Dancing Feet, while I danced with a hat stand, and Edgington with a chair. The denouement. Rosie says, "How about some Artois champagne?" "Champagne? Champagne? Gunner's drinking champagne?" This was called Asti Spumanti. It's more like proof lemonade, but the sheer feeling of luxury made it even more heady. "Core champagne," said Edgington, making it disappear at a great rate. He was at the piano again. We stood around and sang tunes that put an emotional seal on our generation. Along about 2 a.m, we paid the bill, bade noisy good night to Rosie and her husband, and started down the long, winding road to Amalfi. It looked like a silver river. No one was drunk, but we certainly weren't all that steady. There was a lot of sliding and slipping. It was about a mile to the bottom, and I think our gyrations added another 3. The sea front was quiet. A few chinks of light showed through the late windows. I slept to the sound of the sea and the tide of a thunderous snoring from a Neolithic gunner in the next bed, who was fully clothed and sicked on the front of his battle dress. A perfect end to a memorable night. Wednesday, December the 29th, 1943. My diary, nothing. Why did I write it? Files, memorable because we saw the remains of Pompeii. This day was memorable. All the lads left early for Pompeii. Having seen it, I opted to stay in bed. It's a cold, sunny day on this delightful coast. I miss official breakfast, so I go to the little cafe by the cathedral steps. Inside, I find Gunner White and a drunken Scot from 64th Mediums.
Aren't you seen Pompeii? Said White.
Not from here. Anyhow, I hate conducted tours. I ordered 2 eggs and chips from the Signorina.
This place gets a bit boring after 24 hours, said White.
For the first time, the drunken Scots talks.
Ah, aventures! Near Blackwood! I'm out here! Ah, fuck!
Let me describe him. Short, stocky, black hair, red face, and staring blue eyes in a sea of red veins. He had no mouth as such. It looked more like an incision. He reeked of alcohol. The front of his battle dress was a mass of red wine stains. His teeth were Van Gogh yellow, and he hadn't a penny, and sat with anyone who could stand the smell.
I can't get rid of him, said White. He's been with me for 4 hours.
I ate my eggs and chips and yarned with White. The drunken Scot kept interjection with unintelligible Scotch rubbish.
I owl, now I'd near get the idea. Well, there. Ah, fuck.
We get onto the beach and hire a boat.
Yeah, knucklehead, eh? Ah, fuck.
I took the oars and we pulled gently from the shore. Out loud, I quote, all in the golden afternoon, full leisurely we glide.
Yeah, happening. Ah, fuck.
100 yards offshore, I stacked the oars and we just drifted. Wonderful peace. The sun is warm, the air balmy, the water's calm. The terrible Scot is sick, not in the sea. In the boat. We rowed back hurriedly with him downwind.
Oh, fuck,
he said. We climbed the seawall and ran away from the reeking Scot. We walked along the coastal road towards Positano. The afternoon sun was like a warm caress. We slung our jackets over our shoulders. To our right are granite cliffs.
What calls that?
White points to a great cleaves in a hill. That's a fault.
Fault? Whose bloody fault?
Carefully I explained its geological origins.
Oh, he said.
It was a waste of bloody time. If I'd have answered Mussolini's fault, he'd have been just as satisfied.
Fuck!
He'd caught up with us again. We watched men catching octopus along the shore. To kill them, they pulled them inside out. It was obscenely cruel, but then man is...
Do they eat those bloody things?
Yes. White said,
oh, it's like eating bloody worms.
The Anglo-Saxon will devour stale, hard bread, bully beef, hard rolls, food boils to death, obliterated with artificial seasoning, yet delightfully cook octopus and garlic. Oh, no. You are what you eat, and that's why we all look so bloody ugly. Back to the billets, we see that the showers are hot. Yes, but oh God, the news has got around. Crowds of steaming red naked men cram in the bathrooms. There's 5 men to a shower.
It's every man for his bloody self.
So saying, White and I charge our way in. The bodies are so compressed, I'm sure someone else washed my legs by mistake.
Fuck.
The Scot. He's under the shower with us, but he's still in his underwear. All clean and glowing, smelling of Wright's coal tar soap, we are ready for the evening. We are nearly skint, so we have to eat the army grub. We needed every penny to get pissed.
Let's look for someone new.
White is looking up the steps that run up the centre of Amalfi.
Thank fuck we got rid of that bloody jock.
It's evening now. Above, I spot Hesperides. I didn't mention this to White, who was already baffled enough by the geographical fault. All the way up the stairs, at intervals, are little trattorias. We ascend halfway up the town. A pretty girl is standing, inviting us inside a house.
You want a drink, baby?
White needs no second invitation. We go inside.
It's a one-woman brothel. Now, let me explain. These weren't regular whores, but working-class girls who had fallen on hard times and were doing it just for the duration. Inside is a square, whitewashed room with a charcoal burner in the middle. There are simple wooden chairs around the walls. Several simple soldiers are drinking red wine from a large bottle on the central table. A large middle-aged lady in a black dress and another young girl of about 15 pour us some wine. The girl from outside has come in and points to one of the soldiers. They go into the next room and I hear the lock go in the door. I then hear the springs go in the bed. I feel uncomfortable. I'd never had it away with a whore. And being a Roman Catholic by upbringing, the thought of doing it at one horrified me. However, a couple of hours later, I'd blown all my money on wine. And the girl had been through about 6 customers. But she kept looking at me and saying, "You want?" and pointing to the room. I declined, and each time she got angrier. She was, in fact, fancying me. Why not? I was the best-looking one there. My rejections finally drove her to say, you no like me. Why you say no? I explained that I hasn't many. Whereupon, in my drunken state, she grabbed me, ushered me into the next room and screwed me. At the end, I said, "Ninty soldi, ninty soldi." She put her finger to her lips and went, "Shh." "Then wait for it." She gave me 1,000 lira. "Quick! The Guinness Book of Records! Hurry!" "You no speak other soldiers," he confided. "No. You, very good. You come back gain the money note, eh?" My male ego was bursting. After all, she was not a common whore. Common whores wouldn't rate me at 1,000 lira ago. No. This girl had a fine sense of values and a remarkable understanding of currency. But would I catch something? That's the question that haunted me in bed that night. However, I had broken the back of my Roman Catholic inhibitions. What would the Pope say? It all reminded me of the story of a 50-year-old pioneer corps soldier who was caught having a knee tremor one night in a doorway in Bradford. The judge had told him he was a disgrace. There was far too much of this thing going on in town, etc. He was going to make an example of him and gave him 3 months for indecency. The comment from the pioneer soldier was, "I'll tell you something, you'll never stop fucking in Bradford." White is lying on his bed, ecstatic with the evening. "Oh, Mummy," he said suddenly, "I don't want to go back to school." December the 30th, 1943. Diary, got pissed all day. As requested, of course, I went back to the dear girl the next night. She was delighted and screwed me again. As I dressed, I awaited my rightful payment. "That'll be 1,000 lira this time," she said. "Ah, the woman was nothing but a common whore."